Hi, it's Paul Camilos. Welcome to Series 6 of Shooting the Breeze. Join me and my co-host Jacinta Govind alongside the STB crew as we cover women's hoops and women in hoops. We'll share conversations and get a little deeper with inspiring players, amazing coaches, and the legends from behind the scenes. Especially in this series, we'll be talking to dream chasers that give it their all and lead with their heart.
The fork in the road said, well, okay, we've tried for 3 years, we've been turned down. Let's just focus on us. Let's just be the best damn competition that we can be. Let's reward the players with great income. Let's stick to our model because we think we've got a model that works and we're really passionate and strong around that. But let's also build it based on revenue, fans and brand. It's a sustainable model. It's a fun model. We're in the business of entertainment.
In this playback, we have our Changemakers playlist from Series 6. STB movers and shakers, including Justin Nelson, Lauren Gandini, Craig Campbell, and Shelley Matheson. Justin is a true innovator. The Tauihi League in New Zealand is set to expand in 2025 with an Indian team, the Panthers, in what is only its fourth year. Lauren is a change agent as co-founder of Australia's first female athlete sports agency, Stella Athletes. And Australia's national wheelchair coach, Craig Campbell, alongside veteran player Shelley Matheson, reboot the Gliders program after a devastating stall following COVID lockdowns. All guests have had a massive impact in pioneering change and creating opportunities for others in women's hoops.
I think you get a chance when you do something new or you start something from new, you get a chance to do things differently. I'm a really big believer in change and innovation. I think everybody, you know, knows that, and certainly people that would listen to this show would know that as well. I believe I'm an innovator. That's how I sort of position myself. And that's not to say that, you know, I do anything different to other innovators. I think for those that live in the world of innovation, we come up with 50 ideas that we all think are great. You know, and there's only, you know, a couple that may eventually get through. But what we have seen here is Tauihi's been one of those that have been, you know, built from scratch, a lot of innovation around it. Rapid League has been quite outstanding, quite amazing. Now in the men's league here, it started this season and it's just taken off. You know, clearly it's the best thing I've ever innovated in terms of, you know, being on national television nearly every night, being in the news all the time and what it's doing for the careers of young men and women, hoping to aspire to go on to bigger things in basketball and the commerciality of it and all that sort of stuff. So I've been very fortunate, but, you know, a couple of years into Tauihi, geez, there's a lot to like about what's been done and done sustainably as well. I think that was the real thing for me from the start. I wanted to make sure that it was done in a way where everyone was growing together, the teams, the players, the fans, the commercial partners, and we're all getting some level of reward out of it. You know, it's only not even 70 games old. So to be where it is today with the announcements that were recently made around player wages and all that sort of stuff, yeah, I do pinch myself at times. It's been a very, very rapid rise, there's no doubt.
And I suppose one of the big things for me that came out of the recent announcements is you're moving the whole season.
Yeah.
Now, when we originally talked about Tauihi a while back now, one of the things that you mentioned was the concept of getting the players over so that they could play a season, do some national duties, and then be able to move across the WNBL and be able to play there so that they can stay close to home and get a good 8 months worth of basketball in. That's going to change.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm guessing a lot of people are going to be asking the question, why?
Yeah, really simple answer, actually. It's not too complex in terms of the thinking behind it. The original idea of Tauihi was to play in the 2 or 3 months leading up to the WNBL season in Australia, and for New Zealand to then have a team in the WNBL. So it was a case of 5 or 6 teams playing here, a lot of Kiwi talent, giving them the chance to play and be on TV and be in a professional environment with the support of Sky and other commercial partners. And for that to then build into a team based in New Zealand 5 million fans behind it. You know, New Zealand's team playing in the WNBL, coming straight off the back of the Tohe season. So that was the grand plan right at the start when I first designed Tohe back in. I mean, the first thinking of it started at the end of 2020, believe it or not. But we didn't see it come to life until 2022. But that was the original plan. We started the process of getting large investment and large backing to put a team into the WNBL from as early as 2021. And literally for three straight years, we were knocked back. You know, Basketball Australia had no interest in having a team from New Zealand and pretty much gave us that blunt message every time. At its height, we had a commitment of $2 million per year for a minimum of 5 years. That's what people had signed up for or were prepared to sign up for. So we had a $2 million operation ready to go, but we're rejected. We were turned down. So that was the basis of how it started. And then we've still got the investment. We've still got the partners and the commerciality and Sky. So it was a case of looking at it and going, well, okay, what's best for revenue, fans and brand? What's best for the commerciality? What's best for the fans? And what's best for the brand of the teams and also the competition? Remembering that 9 WNBA connected players came and played here last season. So there's a bit of a fascination and love affair for all of us as human beings to come and visit New Zealand anyway. So we've got a bit of a tick in the box before we start. But when we sat back and we looked at the commercial partners and the investment that we had and what we'd already built over 2 years and the fact that we'd been rejected for three straight years to put a team in the Australian competition, where New Zealanders, by the way, can play unrestricted. So players from here can go over there and play without restriction, but you know they didn't want a team from here. So we then looked at what was the best for the business. We're in the entertainment business, and that's how the move came about. The fact is that we have the opportunity to be in an uncluttered market here in New Zealand. It's got nothing to do with anywhere else, but an uncluttered market here in New Zealand in the months of October, November, December. Rugby's finished, the men's basketball season's finished, netball's finished. It's an uncluttered space for sport, an indoor sport, and importantly, a women's sport. So it really suited us from a broadcasting viewpoint. It really suited our commercial partners to have that uncluttered window where they get in the news space more, they get on the television news more, you know, radio. We already have the television coverage, but more eyeballs. It certainly suits our fans because they're not dragged to make three or four different choices around the weekend. They can get behind a sport and really follow it, get behind their team. And then the branding obviously elevates when you haven't got that competition in the market as well here in New Zealand. So the reason why we changed is because our first plan was, you know, we spent 3 years trying to do it and it was turned down. So we went back to focusing on us, just being us and focusing on revenue, fans and brand. And that's why we moved the season. It's nothing more than that.
And still having the potential risk of not, I guess, attracting as many current WNBL players or WNBA affiliated players by moving it and having a sole focus on showcasing the rising talent of New Zealand that you already have.
It didn't really come into our thinking about what players will or won't do. What we wanted to do is to build the business sustainably and put it in a time of the year that suited the business here in New Zealand. But when it came to players, it was about also providing choice and opportunity. Players can play wherever they want. If they want to come to New Zealand and be a part of this competition, there's now really good wages here. But importantly, we think we've got a great model. It's a 12-week window. The fact is, the more we talk to players from all over the world, the more we hear that they love the 12-week window. In this particular case, they're home before Christmas. They get to go and spend Christmas with family and friends in their home, you know, sleeping in their bed, being with their people, and then they can move on to the next gig. You know, there's a lot of Americans at the moment that don't like to go to Europe for 6-7 months. There's a lot of Australians that don't like to go to Europe for 6 or 7 months. Mm-hmm. What we've created, and again, primarily we focused on us. We didn't focus on anyone else, but we knew that we were providing choice and something different. But what we have provided for players, if they want it, no matter where they come from, is 12 weeks, great money, in a great country, in an English-speaking country, where you can come in, play, build your career, go home, Christmas and New Year with family and friends, go on to the next gig. And so far, from what I'm hearing around the teams, there's a lot of excitement from players and agents as well, from all over the world. So I think it's going to really settle in and be something good over the next few years.
Is there some kind of eligibility criteria from BA's perspective of entering a team into WNBL and what some of the reasons were as to why they weren't interested in including a New Zealand team again?
I don't know why they weren't interested, other than, you know, their message to us probably throughout 3 years is we want to focus on getting our backyard right before we expand. You know, we've got some issues here with the competition. We need to fix it before we look at expansion. And that's fair enough. I've got no problems with that. It needs to be fixed. So, you know, it's probably unfortunate that it's taken 3 years and it's still going. You know, there's still things that need to be fixed. But we took a fork in the road. We've got money. We've got backers. We've got a great broadcast partner that's really committed to women's basketball and the growth of girls and women's sports. So we're in a really fortunate position. But the fork in the road said, well, okay, we've tried for 3 years. We've been turned down. Let's just focus on us. Let's just be the best damn competition that we can be. Let's reward the players with great income. Let's stick to our model because we think we've got a model that works and we're really passionate and strong around that. But let's also build it based on revenue, fans and brand. It's a sustainable model. It's a fun model. We're in the business of entertainment. We're innovators. We're not afraid to change. We're not afraid to do things differently. And it's working. So, you know, we're pretty happy with what we've developed in such a short amount of time.
And it's just like one of those cliche moments you hear about, you know, a light bulb sort of goes off and you think that is exactly what I want to do with my life. It sort of combined for me, that idea combined everything I had ever been passionate about and felt like I could offer the world. So, yeah, that's how it began pretty much from there. You know, we sat down and did a few business plans and almost 3 years later, here we are.
And it's too bad this episode aren't recording any video, because I think what I love the most about you giving that answer is how much you were smiling when you were speaking, because that tells us that you obviously love it.
Yes. And again, it feels like such a cliche thing to say. And running your own small business while you have, yeah, similarly small child, that's not been easy, but it's the love of this job and getting to make such an impact that makes it so rewarding.
At the moment, you're 3 years in. How many athletes do you have with the agency?
So we have approximately 80 at the moment. We do work across several sports and we've got a team of 5 agents at the moment. We've sort of got one agent specialising in each sport. That's the model we're going down. But we've got also the model where, you know, agents can cross sports to support as well. So that's been an exciting part of it. And it's been really exciting getting more women in the agency space as well, because it's traditionally been very, very male dominated space.
And I know this is a cliche as well, but I think most people, their start and finish of an agent and an agency kind of runs with what they've seen in Jerry Maguire.
Yes.
Right. Now,
for sure.
I'm guessing it's nothing like that in reality.
I think agency has come a long way, but I always say to people, I feel like the messaging behind Jerry Maguire is fantastic, because at the end of the day, it's just like my career as a lawyer. It's about the care for the athlete, the really genuine care about them, and not just churning them out as a product. And I feel like, you know, definitely there's some industries that operate that way, but I do feel optimistic that we've shifted much more towards our best interests. Yeah, really acting in the best interest of an athlete rather than, like I said, just sort of churning out the product and taking the 10% and see you later. So I love the messaging behind Jerry Maguire when he's got, yeah, he wants to do it differently. But a lot of it might be quite, it's a little bit Americanized, that movie, but some of it aren't too far off, to be honest.
One of the things that's always fascinated me is the approach you would take to identify athletes that you want to have with your agency, because I'm guessing there's always more athletes than an agency can handle at any particular point in time.
Yes.
What's the process you use?
So it's actually very different for every sport, which makes things fun. I'll use AFL just as an example. I know we're on a basketball show, but AFL, for example, and this is the same in men's and women's, they actually have a portal. If they're under 18 years of age, that you have to actually go through this portal and send them a letter, and it goes to them, their parents, their talent manager, you know, their club sort of manager, and then you have to wait 7 days, and it's a real process in our Aussie rules comp in terms of, you know, yeah, you sort of identify the talent, and then it's very strict around how you approach them. And I guess for those sorts of sports, you know, you're just really looking at the talent pathways. There's definitely some mature age talent, but, you know, very much, yeah, sort of those pathway talent. Basketball's a bit different because, as we know, the college system is so huge in basketball, and a lot of sports don't have that college system. So I would say predominantly the talent comes from the college pathway, but it's also very worthwhile keeping an eye on the junior talent, because some players don't go to college and they, you know, they choose to go straight to professional at 17 or 18. And then you've also got the high performers at NBL1 that might have, you know, missed, didn't go to college, or, you know, miss their chance in pathways and sort of get a contract from there. My sister Emma is a great example of that. She got her first pro contract at, I think it was 26, 27, because she just had been such a defensive pest in the league for so long, you know, playing against some of the best players, playing some of the best WNBL players. So I think clubs are really willing to look at the NBL1 as well as that feeder league to sort of reward the high performers there.
And especially NBL1, more and more, obviously depending on conference, but I'd say more and more being able to secure stable sponsorship and finances. And I think female athletes in particular are probably in a really good position now to start really properly shopping around to find the best Absolutely. Opportunity and contract for them in NBL1.
Absolutely. I have been so impressed with the NBL1 competition. I don't think there's anything else quite like it in the world in terms of the level of professionalism and how people can, yeah, sort of, you know, use this as a really legitimate part-time. Sometimes it's a, you know, sort of a full-time job for them. And it absolutely then, yeah, gives us a really useful role there too, because players can definitely use it as more, you know, loyalty is important, and obviously there's lots of factors that go into a basketball decision, but also, you know, especially females are now empowered to go, actually, I'm going to go to market and I'm going to see what's out there. And in my view, so they should.
And does your process when you're working particularly with local female basketball players, does your process of working with them and trying to find them, you know, the best opportunity for them at that point in time in their career, is it different when they're looking for local opportunities versus opportunities overseas?
Yes and no. Probably what our main role is, the way we approach things is we have the connection with the club. You know, we get everything together for the player and we go, right, we've got all your stats, we've got your highlights, we've got everything ready to go. And then we connect with the club and we're really providing an offering. You know, we're sort of saying, you know, here's what we've got. You know, we might say to them, what are you looking for? You know, what do you need here? And then we can sort of help them suggest. And although it might be different in other leagues, the way that's approached, it is a similar approach in that you really are working a bit more with the club to say, well, hey, yeah, we've got this roster, but what is it that your team needs? So obviously overseas is a bit different in that there's a few more checks that you want to be doing, because obviously in Australia, you know, even if you've never heard of a town, you can be pretty sure they're going to be pretty well looked after and they're still in the country. It's probably more so when you're looking at the overseas things, you're just looking at some of those extra checks to make sure you're sending them somewhere safe, essentially.
When you're putting together that package to take to a club, does it vary from player to player how you structure that package, or is it more like this is how we do it?
So at the first, it's quite a general overview, and it's really just got quick snippets of every player's information. And then once a club say that, oh, I quite like that player, I know that player, I want to hear more about it, then we've got a bit more information sort of on hand to say, right, well, here's two or three paragraphs, and here's maybe some other clips, and here's their goals, their strengths, that sort of thing. So at the start, yeah, it is quite a general overview, but then sort of break it down to more information.
You've been involved, as you said, you've played
sport, it must give you a unique perspective, because it's like you've been on both sides of the fence. You know, how do you find that things have evolved over time, particularly with, you know, the growing professionalism in women's sports, growth of NBL One? How have you found that things have shifted over the period of time that you've been involved with sport, and particularly over the last 3 years?
Yeah, look, just especially in basketball, the impact that I have seen, you know, I played, I think I had an 11 or 12 year career, and, you know, for the most of it, we'd have six people at our games, and it would be like, you know, my dad and a couple of friends that wanted to have a few cruises in the box and watch the game. Like, whereas that same club now, they sell out every single game, men's and women's, and it's phenomenal. And it's the clubs should be credited for that, for going, you know, what if we market this, men's and women, you know, we market it the right way, we'll get people there. And then obviously they, you know, there's a lot of financial considerations for clubs, but, you know, the more people that are coming to watch the games, the better that club can do for the entertainment value as well. So that's probably one of the biggest observations I've seen. That's terrific. Another point is probably the equal media exposure. I remember, and again, this was towards the end of my career, so it wasn't too long ago, the live broadcasting was just starting. Now, at that time, I was playing for a club where the women's team had had significantly more success than the men's. And to be honest, they probably had more people coming to watch. You know, people would go to the women's game and then leave. Left for the men's. Like, they had a really strong, they were a very good club and they had a really strong following. Yet they brought out we're going to do a game of the week. It wasn't a K, it was a very basic one. And they said, we're just doing the men's. And our team said, huh? Why? You're there. You know, you're there and it's this and this is important. And, you know, very quickly, to their credit, they did get back to us. But they really put on the whole, well, you know, you've got to do more to market the sport before people want to hear and read about it. And it's like, what do you mean? Like, that's, you're going to be right there. Surely it's not too much, you know, for you to just do the women's game too. Anyway, it wasn't just me. There was a few players that really went, you know, firmly at that. And from that next week on, men and women's every week. And we see the standard now being on KO. Like, that's a phenomenal service and product.
Yeah, we had Craig Friday coaching both teams, and a bunch of things off court with different restrictions we had in the village there. So from there, being able to come in and sort of build and then being formalised, ready for the qualifiers in Phuket, we sort of worked through and started to build that process. You know, there were some changes from there as well, with, you know, Ellis Abeljack going on to success with wheelchair rugby after being with the Gliders for a period. So we knew that, you know, we're a good breeding ground for athletes. We need to work that next gen and keep working through. So understanding, I guess, where we've been and having been involved since 2017, coming across from the men's program, and then working with David Gould, you know, Stephen Charlton, Craig Friday, having Murray in there as well as a mentor within the coaching group for a while too. There was lots of different things that we worked through, and things that went well, and other things that we could continue to build on. And with different groups, we need to do things a different way. So it was largely about teaching again and getting things back for people who hadn't been to those experiences, particularly when we're in lockdowns. We didn't have national leagues. We didn't have opportunities to play. We had opportunities to train. How can we make that competitive? How can we feel like we're going back to COVID news breaks, where how can we be together while we're apart? But we still have that, where we're a decentralized program. You know, we have Hannah Dodd playing in Europe, and we have other athletes all around the country, some in a daily training environment with one or two athletes, some lucky enough to have up to 10 or 12. You know, others are by themselves in the middle of, you know, either Bathurst or Parks, and down in Tasmania as well with Georgie Gott. So we need to work out how we can get that done. So a large part was working out how we can build on that, how we can start to have that foundation and bring those things in that people are going to need in their toolkit. And that's getting good people involved. So Tina McKenzie coming back involved as an assistant coach with the experience, and being an ex-captain of the Gliders as well. Having people like that who want to be around and want to get involved, that was a big part of that. One thing we did before we got to a post-mortem after the repercharge, and we probably didn't really, I don't think we actually did a post-mortem. We definitely did reflections, and we worked out, okay, where are we at? You know, we talk at times that we don't coach athletes, we coach people who are athletes and competitors. So we need to have that people first approach is what we did. And we worked with Ross Pindar, who has just changed roles from Paralympics Australia, but he had, it seemed like just a casual line about pre-mortem. when we play sport, there's two options. There's you win, particularly elite wheelchair basketball. You can either win or you have the alternative. Some people refer to it as losing, others refer to it as learning. But what happens if that one game that we've got coming up that counts for whether we get in or not, what happens after that? So we knew the athletes we had. We knew that they're people. We know that people have given lots. You know, we were lucky enough to be able to have two people in our team, two mums come on tour with us, be able to work out how we can make sure their kids could be there. And, you know, getting a five from Link after you lose a qualifying game, because that's what you do after the game. There's bigger things than basketball. So I think a big part of it was realizing, what do we have? What are the actual possibilities? How do we work like ugly to make sure that we get the right option? History shows that we didn't get that, but then how do we make sure we look after our people? And that's a big part of it. So knowing everybody has, or most people have, some kind of insurance, you hope you never need to use it, but we had to go through and work out what's our insurance to make sure our people are going to be all right, and what do we need to do in terms of creating high performance habits, creating accountability, making sure we do have the right connection with all our people involved on and off court to make sure we can be successful as we move forward. And I think people who even aren't close to being involved in the game probably know that this sucks a bit, and this is like, it's, what are we, we're almost 2 months since there, but it, you know, it doesn't suck any less, but there's going to be another game of wheelchair basketball. Like the 2nd of July versus Japan is another game of wheelchair basketball. Like the game goes on, and, you know, Chaps touched on before about, you know, there's gliders from the past, and, you know, anybody who's played for the gliders at some point in time will have said once a glider, always a glider. So we need to know that there's actually going to be an opportunity for more people to be a glider in the future. So how do we do that? How do we support those that are here, particularly when we've got so many young athletes? And we know, you know, the number of games is around 80 international games, realistically, to be ready to compete. We've got a lot of athletes who, we've had about 3 or 4 who've just ticked over 50 games, who've been around for a number of years because of the lockdowns. We've got some athletes, like we've got a 14-year-old athlete in WA who's turning heads and doing things that it takes, sorry, sometimes we say younger athletes are doing things that they don't realise they shouldn't be able to do yet. She's putting in hard work with Jamie O'Loughlin and Brad Ness, and she's doing things way before what other people would be able to do who are experiencing the game. So we've got so much potential there. It's really about setting them up, and that's been our focus, about how we can set people up for success, not just in the immediate future, but making sure that's a program that goes well and truly beyond my time and, you know, anybody else who's involved at the moment, so that people can sit back and enjoy and cheer the gliders on for years to come.
There's a lot there to unpack. I mean, obviously, there's two sides to it. There's the training side. There's the physical work out there on the court. But as you rightly mentioned, there's the whole other side of it, which is the people themselves. It seems as though, particularly with the gliders, that's a very important part of your ethos and your direction. How do you see that developing over time?
I think a large part of it is about the connecting and the connection. Like we have, you know, people like Bridie Keane and Kylie Gouch, who came back into our group, and, you know, part of, I don't know whether people call it the madness behind the method or the reasoning, you know, why we were looking at that. It was looking at, you know, how can we try and make sure that these emerging athletes have got the best chance to go through. And, you know, imagine, we know that Bridie, Deputy Chef Michon, you know, wouldn't be available to play in Paris. But, you know, she was like, I'm that committed to the gliders. Can I help you get there? So then we can make sure one of these emerging athletes can have that experience of Paris, so that we can know, okay, this is what it's about. We know when we go to all qualifiers, everything speeds up. The hits are harder. You know, the shooting percentage, you know, they drop a lot quicker, the shot gets off quicker. So how can we make sure we can set people up for success and understand what it is? Like the difference between training here by yourself versus competing against the Netherlands, the US, competing against China, who are the most dominant team in our zone at the moment, silver medalists from the last World Championships and Paralympics. We know that we have to be at our best and understand, okay, that's where we need to aim to get to there. And then the next level is to make sure we take their spot. So, you know, having people willing to come back in and do that shows that they're invested. It's not about, you know, winning the medal right now, but it's about making sure there's the opportunity for others to be in an environment where they can succeed. So setting them up for success. It makes it easy when you have other people wanting to say, yes, I'll commit my time. I'll, you know, come away from work, I'll come away from some of my family to make sure I can come on a tour to Osaka. I'll make sure that I can be available for a weekend camp so we can get to know people and get to know the other players, start to mentor them. And then also after that, I'll still be, you know, although I've been through this experience where not part of that qualification, but I'm still on the phone, I'm still checking in with athletes who weren't even at the repechage because I know that they're going to be somebody next and we've got that connection and that link to how we go. If you've got people doing that around you, it's pretty tough not to focus on the people and work out how we can support them for that.
Mm. And you mentioned, you know, you had Kylie Gauci come back, and we've had Kylie on the podcast in the past. And, you know, at the time when we spoke to her, I don't think it was in her forward vision that she'd be going back. And obviously, this kind of leads into you, Shelley. You came back after 5 years, I think.
Yeah.
You know, for the Oceania zone qualifiers, what triggered that for you? And what's it like getting back on the court at that level after being away for a while?
The truth of it all is that Troy invited me to play in, we had one round of women's nationals last year. And Troy Sachs said, come play. And I was 12 months postpartum, so Hazel was about to turn one. And I thought, you know what, if someone's going to pay for me to go to Queensland, my whole family to come to Queensland, which is where Bridie Keane lives, I'm going. I don't care. I'm not fit to play basketball. No way. And I hadn't touched my basketball chair, actually, since the 2018 World Championships. Like, unexpectedly gotten pregnant with Ruby. And, yeah, basketball was so far from my mind. But I thought, you know what, if a free holiday to Queensland, I'll go. And then I got on court and I loved every second of it. You know, I definitely was not a superstar, but I was like, you know what, I can still compete with these girls. These girls have just come off of a World Championships. They came fifth in the world. You know what, I'm still in the mix here. I'm not 100 years away. Anyway, and I actually went home and I joined the local gym and I ordered a new basketball chair because I was like, next year I'm going to be fit to compete against these girls in the National League when I get another chance to play. And then later that week, Craig put out an EOI and Bridie and I were going back and forth. And we said, you know what? We'll just prove a point here that we deserve to be in the mix. And so we put our names in and I went to training a couple of weeks later and Craig's like, yes, yeah, we'll have you.
Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you get our latest pod. And we really appreciate if we could get a like and a review so we can extend the reach to more listeners. And don't forget, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn.